here today to talk to you guys about households, about families. So first, I want to start by asking you, what does a household look like? You just shout it out. Yeah. Running around. Okay. A little chaos. Comfort. What else? What's that? Protection. Cool. So I'm going to talk to you about what my household has looked like throughout my life. Just so we have like sort of an example. So my parents separated when I was 18 months old. My dad decided he kind of wanted to see the world. And when he got back, he met a new wife and he started a new family. And they got him about 29 days out of the month and I got him on the 30th. So I didn't have a very traditional nuclear family when I was young. But some of my earliest memories were picking fruit in the garden with my mom. I was too young to understand economics and market forces and the early 80s recession, but I did understand that we were on welfare and that the cheese and peanut butter came from the government. I don't remember how long my mom was single and unemployed, but she made really good use of this time and spent it raising her son primarily. We actually lived on the edge of a vineyard, so our backyard was the test plot for the vineyard, and we had like a dozen varieties of grapes. And I still totally remember the flavor of these sun-ripe, wonderful muscat grapes bursting in my mouth. Then later, when I was about 8 years old, my mom left her job, and we moved across the state to live with her new boyfriend. It is probably the closest I ever came to a traditional nuclear family with a father and a mother. Ironically, though, he eventually became verbally abusive and kind of terrorized me into, like, the worst time in my life. Eventually, though, we got out of that situation, and I was very relieved that it was just my mom and I, but now being a teenager, that relationship became a lot more stressed and was a lot harder to deal with. So as soon as I graduated high school, I moved out, went to college, became a celibate monk, lived in intentional communities, traveled the world alone, gave up being a celibate monk, had dozens of roommates, swore to never have roommates again, lived alone, and then had more roommates. So, like many people in my generation, I've been single and living very far away from my birth family for almost 15 years now. So that's been about half of my life has been a single person. So pretty much everything I can call a family or a household was completely unheard of 60 years ago. This idea that like a bunch of 30-year-olds living together sharing an apartment, preposterous. But it's not like that was some watershed moment in the 1950s. If you went back even further to the 1880s, like a lot of those families from the 1950s would be like, what are these like 12 children families on the prairie? It's like households, our idea of a household just keeps changing over time. And if you go even further back to like ancient times, you have like clans and Bedouin tribes and the Greco-Roman households that were full of all these people that aren't even related to you. So we see throughout history that what it means to be part of a household is constantly changing. There's a huge diversity in sizes and shapes. And so we're actually going to be looking at a household code, which was written in the Greco-Roman times. And household code is basically just a way to write down. It's sort of a framework of how a house should run, how a family should function. They were really popular in Roman times. Greek and Roman philosophers loved to codify things. And they basically saw families as like the tiniest Lego block for building societies. So it was really important for them to codify how a family should run because that was how societies worked. And it's interesting because the passage we're going to look at today, you'd think that running a family would be pretty innocuous and straightforward. But this particular passage has had a very storied history throughout history. It's been used and abused both to help lift people up, but also to push people down. And so today, what I want you to take away from my sermon is I want you to leave with an understanding that this household code is a guide for creating households of harmony, households which stand against oppression, households which free and equalize their members as children of God, and even create harmony that ripples away from a single family and out into the world. That's the message I want you to hear today. I think part of the reason why people kind of misunderstand this passage and use it to keep people down is that this passage is written in two different contexts. And if you don't understand both contexts, you miss the meaning of the message. It's sort of like overhearing a single line of a conversation as you walk by. It can mean something wildly different if you don't hear the rest of the conversation. So the first context that I want to talk to you about is the context of the whole Bible. You may have heard the saying, the best commentary on the Bible is the Bible. We know, so I believe that the Bible is an inspired work. Even though it has many human authors through history, it has one author that has kept it consistent from beginning to end, and that author is God. I believe that if you ever find a contradiction in the Bible, it's not a contradiction in the Bible, it's a contradiction in your interpretation of the Bible. And so, with that in mind, we know that the Bible is a message that frees people from oppression. In Amos, it says, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. That's not just, hey, you know, make your courts fair. It means be washed away by the tsunami of justice in your society. That's what we should be building. Proverbs says that whoever oppresses the poor man insults his maker, but he who is generous generous to the needy honors him. So even God associates himself with the needy. And perhaps most importantly, Jesus opens his ministry by unrolling the scroll of scriptures and reading this. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord. So everything that Jesus came to earth, he set out to liberate the captives and to preach good news to the poor. And as his body today, we should understand everything we do as freeing people from oppression. We also know that the Bible contains clear and unambiguous proclamations of the value of all people. There's the very famous one, there is neither Jew nor Greek, no male nor female, slave nor free in Christ, for we are all one. We can remember that the last disciples at the cross with Jesus and the first witnesses of his resurrection were women, in a time when the testimony of women wasn't even admitted into court. And from the very beginning, God created humans in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. So when we look at each other, we see God. That's our value. But despite this message, the Bible has been misused over and over by people to oppress others, particularly those without power. This passage that we're going to study this week, and I haven't read it yet because I want you to come to this passage understanding the context it's written into, and to see it with bias stripped away. This particular passage has been used to endorse slavery because it makes some rules for how masters should treat their slaves, and so people reasoned, you know, if there are rules about slavery, it means that we should have it. It's God's will to have slavery, but I don't think that's true. It's also been used to oppress women and to put them in their place. The Bible has been used a lot of times to justify violence against people that we judge to be sinners. But the Bible also says that we are no one's judge. That's not our job. And so all of these actions are actually counter to what the Bible intends, and that they are a corruption of that total message. So that's the first context I want you to remember. It's the total message of the Bible. The second context I want to tell you about is the Greco-Roman culture that this passage was written into. In Rome, the way things worked were very patriarchal and very oppressive to all kinds of people. And we need to understand the message of this passage in that context, and only then can we understand how it applies to our context. And I said a word there a minute ago, patriarchy. And so I want to break down what patriarchy means. So basically, a patriarch, it's a Latin word for father. And then a patriarchy, is like a monarchy, basically means it's the rule of a father. And so in Roman times, there was something called patris potesta, which basically means the power of the father. And there was a certain person in every household who was the patriarch. It had to be a male, and it had to be the oldest male. And so even if dad died and there was a 12-year-old son, this 12-year-old son is now in charge. The patriarch had all sorts of powers over his family. The power of ownership. So if anybody in the house acquired something, they couldn't own it. Only the patriarch could own that thing, and all the possessions of the family were his. The patriarch also had the power of punishment over his family. He was the enforcer. And that went so far as Roman law actually codified that patriarchs could punish and execute their family if appropriate. So, like, this is pretty serious stuff. And then around the patriarch, these household codes were written. And so Aristotle, actually long before Jesus was around, wrote a very early household code. And he said, I'll just read you some excerpts from it. He said, there are three parts of rule. One is the rule of a master over slaves, another of father, and the third of husband. A husband and father rules over wife and children, both free, but the rule differs. The rule over the children being royal, and over his wife a constitutional one. He says that males are fitter for command and that they are superior. He goes on to say that although the parts of the soul are present in all people, they're present in different degrees. Yeah, I don't like that idea at all, that somehow your soul is less than mine or mine is less than yours. I don't buy that at all. There's also a contemporary to Paul. While Paul was writing his household code, there was a Jewish philosopher, Philo, and he said, wives must be in servitude to their husband, a servitude not imposed by violent ill temperament, but promoting obedience in all things. Parents must have power over their children. The same holds for any other person over whom the man has authority. All of these codes are arranged around the patriarch. They're all addressed to the patriarch. They're about the relationship between the patriarch and his household. They're about how he rules over his wife, children, and slaves. They're all about his superiority. So now let's go to the passage and let's read Paul's version of a household code. He begins with, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives, as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing water of the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is very profound. And I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love your wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. He goes on to address other members of the household. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and your mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Servants, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ, not by the way of eye service, as people pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, that he will receive back from the Lord, whether he's a bondservant or free. And masters, do the same then, and stop your threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with him. So we see here that Paul has kind of written a parody of the household times of his days. He's saying something very different than Aristotle. He addresses both the husband and the wife, the parent and the child, the master and the servant. Paul also, instead of saying the word obedience for wives, he says submission, something that we should all be doing towards each other. He could have used the word obedience because he uses it a little later to talk to children obeying their parents. And I think really interestingly, too, where the Roman law said that patriarchs had the power to kill their family, Paul calls the father to sacrifice themselves for their family. I think what all of this says, I got skipped ahead. I'm going to go back a little bit. So in the middle of this first part where he addresses husbands, I think Paul makes a sort of aside. He says that in the same way we know that a man and a woman become the same flesh, Christ has become the same flesh as the church. And that this mystery is very profound. There's a lot to dig out of there. I think he's offering some further advice, or some motivation, for husbands to understand this relationship to their wives, to do what Christ did, to sacrifice and nourish and cherish. And I think if you look through each of these relationships, what you see is that instead of the patriarch being at the center of the household, we find Christ at the center of all of those relationships. It's about, at the core of each of these relationships in the household, we find God. And I think that's the most powerful thing about how our household should run. I mentioned before that a lot of people see this section about servants, sometimes translated slaves, and they say, here are rules for slavery. We should have slaves. But we also know from the total context of the Bible, when Paul writes in Philemon about how a Christian master and a Christian slave who is there with Paul, like these are real people, he says, hey, you should let this guy free so that he can do ministry. And I love this line from Paul. He's like, you know, I won't mention how much you owe me. I brought you the gospel and eternal salvation. I won't bring that up. But if you're worried about the financial loss of losing this slave, you can credit it to me. I'll pay for that. There's a whole lot of things about this, and we're going to spend the next couple of weeks digging into each section of this household code. So we'll come back to things like how servants and masters should relate and what that means for us today. But I just wanted to call that one out particularly. So we know two things. We've gotten to this point. We know that the Bible is a message that frees from oppression and powerlessness. And we know that in ancient culture, this message in this text, it was counter to the disharmony and oppression that was embodied in that culture. From those two points, we can conclude that Paul wrote this household code as a tool against the oppression of Roman patriarchy. And we should understand this passage as a progressive weapon of equality. We should understand that this passage should not be used to endorse American slavery as it has been in the past. It should not be used to deny women equal treatment and access to things like voting and property ownership and jobs outside the home. We know that this message from the Bible is one that is free from racism, sexism, and exclusionary oppression. And even though in America, the church in a lot of times has played a role in transforming our culture to be much closer to the way God wants us to be. In 2016, I think we're actually closer to the solution to this world of equality than we are close to Roman patriarchy 2,000 years ago. And that's really good. And the church has been instrumental in some of those changes. But that also leaves us a question. If we are further away from the Roman patriarchy than we are to the solution, how do we apply this to ourselves? What does this household code mean to us? And I think at its core, over and over again, you see that Paul is saying, don't be domineering. And that doesn't matter whether it's with your wife or with your children or with your employees. We should be people that submit to each other. People who are about compromise and equality and love and justice. How do we empower each other? I think we also need to recognize that while there are pieces in this passage where Paul accepts the cultural reality of the day, we need to understand those passages as description. Those pieces are about describing the situation that he's in, not commandments for us. And long ago in the ancient world, gave up things like gladiatorial combat, we also have been freed from those traditions. And we don't need to maintain patriarchy any more than we need to maintain gladiatorial combat. We should unteach this idea that a wife should blindly obey her husband. That's not what this passage says. We should understand it instead in the context of a house where we are all submitting to each other. And in the context of a church where all of us are continually submitting to each other. We should stamp out domestic oppression and replace it with mutual sacrifice. So we can understand this passage, this code that Paul has written, as a code that creates houses of harmony, houses that stand against oppression. And even if the cultural forms have fallen away, we don't have slaves anymore, we must still adopt the spirit of this message: compromise, harmony, and justice. So I want you to think about, what would Paul write as an American household code? How would he call us further towards equality and fairness? We're going to spend the next couple of weeks, as I said, digging into that and looking at it. And as we do that, I want you to keep asking yourself, what would Paul write to my single household of roommates? What would Paul write to my mom's single mother household? And particularly, what kind of household code would Paul write for your household?